is truth in theology? How do we deal with truth claims from different theologies that seem to conflict and so on? These are the topics that we'll be exploring here today. And I'll introduce all three speakers in the beginning, and then let each speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a general discussion afterwards. We have Professor Keith Ward, who needs no introduction, really. He was until 2004, if I remember correctly, Regents Professor of Divinity, the author of many, many books, the latest of which is Christ and the Cosmos, a reformulation of Trinitarian doctrine, which came out just a little while ago by Cambridge University Press. We have Dr. Ankur Barua, lecturer in Hindu studies from Cambridge University, author of The Divine Body in History, a comparative study of time and embodiment in the theologies of St. Augustine and Ramanuja, and very recently as well, Debating Conversion in Hinduism and Christianity. And finally, we have Dr. Jessica Fraser, a lecturer at Kent, University of Kent, research fellow here at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, BBC broadcaster, and author of several books. The most recent, if memory serves me well, being the continuing companion to Hindu Studies. Ankur will speak first, and then Professor Keith Ward, and then Jessica Fraser. So, Ankur.
Thank you, Rembert, and good afternoon to all of you. Let me begin by saying that, as Rembert pointed out, I'm the lecturer in Hindu studies, and these days, most of my time I spend in the library reading some texts in medieval Sanskrit, sometimes early Bengali and Hindi. But 22 years ago, when I came to study theology, there was much more fire in my life. And I came to study theology to answer one question, which I have sort of lost along the way, but I'm trying to revisit it today, very briefly, in 20 minutes, which is this. Is it possible to use reason to answer this question, which is the ultimate truth? Is it some pattern of Christian discipleship, or is it a form of bhakti to Vishnu? And roughly I came to this question when I was 18 years old because of some peculiarities about me. My mother was a Vaishnavite Hindu, which makes me a Hindu in some respect. But I was raised by a devout Roman Catholic aunt. So when I was 18 years old, you can see where I was. You know, am I a Hindu? Am I a Catholic? How do I find out? Do I use reason? Do I appeal to scriptural authority? Whose scriptural authority? How do I decide which way to go? So then I started studying more and more theology, and then I realized why it is so difficult to answer this question. And very roughly, here is my answer in the form of one sentence. That what is one theologian's deep, profound mystery is another theologian's radical incoherence. That is, what you might believe, if you are a theologian from one ontological horizon, is profoundly mysterious. If you are a philosopher or a thinker from another horizon, you will see this as radically incoherent. So I will give you two examples of this. So let me say that if you are St. Teresa of Avila, and you are developing a form of mystical theology, this is what you will believe. That the ontologically distinct, metaphysically distinct, in some sense, Christ, has regenerated you, and you are again ontologically distinct in some sense. And this operation of grace, the Holy Spirit on you, has brought about a real transformation in you. Now, how can you be other than the Lord who encompasses you in every manner? It's a profound mystery. Right? So we are not able to use human reason to explain how can the ontologically distinct, in some sense, Christ, bring about a real transformation in me who am distinct in some sense. It's a profound mystery. It's called the mystery of the incarnation, mystery of Christ. Now, from Advaita perspectives, Advaita will define terms like substance, category, transformation, change in such a way that what I said just now contains an implicit contradiction which can be made explicit. So in other words, the terms substance, change, transformation, time, space are defined in such a way from certain Advaitic axioms that such a thing cannot be mystery, it cannot be mysterious, but is, as I said, profoundly incoherent. Now that is between, say, Saint Teresa of Avila and, say, some Advaitin thinker. But let's repeat the same process between Advaita and, say, Bengal Vaishnavism, Achintya Bheda Bheda, right? Now, from the perspective of Bengal Vaishnavism, the relationship between the Lord and the finite world is simultaneously difference and non-difference. How is such a thing possible? It is Achintya. Don't ask me. I cannot use reason to explain this. But what for Jiva Goswami or some of these figures is Achintya is in fact Maya and therefore radically incoherent from some Advaita perspectives. So the reason why metaphysical debates remain so intractable is not because one person is being rational, the other person is being irrational, but because two people are using reason on distinct hermeneutical ontological horizons. So because you are carving up the ontological landscape in a very different way, what you think as the premise and what you therefore conclude as the final siddhanta or the solution will be very different from somebody who does not share your ontological horizons. Now, as I begin to understand this more and more, I also begin to see that Hindu thinkers, that is thinkers who would describe themselves as Hindu, Hindu thinkers, figures, philosophers, these days do not talk about truth, right? So they will minutely dissect texts, they will do ethnographic work, they will develop post-colonial critiques of Christianity and other things. All of this is not to, of course, to deny the significance of all of this, but simply to say that that is not what I was looking for when I was 18 years old. I wanted to know, if I read a text from Jiva Goswami or from Shankara, or for that matter from Saint Teresa of Avila, I don't want to know things like who wrote this, when was this written, what is the literary form or structure. I wanted to know, as a young man of 18, is it true? Why can't you just tell me whether it's true or not? And if you know that you cannot answer this question, you should say this in the forum, that this is just my personal view of how this argument is being spelled out. I don't necessarily believe all of this now. This is me going back to when I was 18 years old. So I realize that there are five reasons, which I will try to quickly summarize in the remaining 15 minutes, as to why I think the question of truth does not turn up in Hindu academic discourse of religion. The first is, till about the 1980s, there was the conflation of Hinduism with what was called in colonial India, the higher Hinduism, with what was called Vedanta, and by that they meant Advaita Vedanta. So Hinduism is Advaita Vedanta, and therefore the question of truth is irrelevant because Advaita Vedanta is the truth. So Advaita Vedanta is the capital T truth to supersede all truths, is the religion, capital R religion, to end all religions. And once you are there, all of this is simply penultimate truth-seeking, which is not required from the summit, from the ultimate summit. Now, this is, of course, a very complex matter, so whatever I'm going to say about these things is going to be, you know, only by way of scratching the surface. So if you read a medieval Advaitin, such as Madhusudana Saraswati, who writes his Advaita Siddhi, he does not spring the Advaita ultimate upon you as a surprise. He takes you through a minute dissection of every possible ontological view on the horizon. And he will dismantle them, reconstruct them, and then take you there. But I don't think there is any modern Advaitin there who has repeated the work of Madhusudana Saraswati with respect to Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and modern forms of atheism, metaphysical naturalism, and then concluded that Advaita is the religion to end all religions. But because of this pervasive association between Hinduism and Advaita Vedanta, which is taken to have demonstrated that the transpersonal absolute with which we are metaphysically non-dual is the final word of the matter, therefore, truth is not important. The truth, capital T, has already been found. Now, here's the second reason why truth does not turn up. The association between truth-seeking and religious violence. Now, from 1920s onwards in colonial India, you begin to find a construct, I don't say invention, a construct called modern Vedanta, where this civilizational clash is set up between Eastern mysticism and Abrahamic monotheism. These are my terms, they would have said Semitic religion. So Eastern mysticism and Semitic monotheism or Semitic religion, which are, to use my color coding, such that Eastern mysticism is green and Abrahamic monotheism is red. Like, that is to say, Eastern mysticism is all about expressing yourself, liberty of expression, a freedom of spiritual experimentation, whereas Abrahamic monotheisms inevitably lead to bigotry, authoritarianism, violence, persecution of heretics, dissidents, and women. Right? So there is a sort of binary opposition. Therefore, the reason why we Hindus don't need truth is because you see what truth did to the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians. It is when people start talking about truth that it leads to violence. But we Hindus have something better than truth. We have spirituality. And spirituality is beyond all truth-seeking. And this is the summit, this is the ultimate metaphysical peak from which we look down at the historical religions fighting it out on that ontological conceptual terrain. But here is where the problem starts. When you start asking this question, what is this metaphysical peak? So we are trying to bypass the first order question about what is truth through an appeal to the second order level of the metaphysical ultimate. But what is the metaphysical ultimate? Madhusudana Saraswati will say this is the transpersonal Brahman. Jiva Goswami will say this is Krishna Bhakti. Shaivite theologians will say this is Bhakti to Shiva. So what you are trying to throw out through the front door comes knocking back at the back door, right? So this appeal to spirituality and not truth-seeking does not really get us anywhere, metaphysically speaking, right? Politically, sociologically, yes, maybe it is the case, this is again a very complex debate, as to why is it the case that Eastern mysticism has not been associated with things like the Spanish Inquisition, right? So how do you explain this lack or this absence? My quick answer to that is, this is how you should not explain it. You should not explain it by saying that Eastern mysticism is intrinsically peace-engendering and Semitic religions are intrinsically violent, right? Because this is simply Orientalism in the reverse. That is what you are doing, you are accepting the East-West binary and reversing the polarity and saying that Hindus are intrinsically peace-loving, whereas Abrahamic monotheisms cannot not lead to violence, persecution, and all kinds of terrible atrocities. So why is it that the Hindu cultures, Hindu universes traditionally have had this rather relaxed attitude to what is going on to neighbors or what is going on to people in Peru and South Africa and Australia? You do not usually find Hindus terribly worried about what's happening to people in Alaska, right? And a quick answer to this is the doctrine of karma and reincarnation. And this is what you find both in Vaishnavite context and in Advaitin context, that we should let people follow their own Swadharma, their own religious paths, because ultimately they will come back to where we are. Say, here are two very quick quotations from one figure called Swami Bhakti Hriday Bon Maharaj from the Bengali Vaishnava tradition. An individual must have developed through practices in various births a given degree of intellectual and moral maturity before he or she can aspire to understand, practice, and follow and realize absolute knowledge. And what he means by absolute knowledge is, of course, Krishna Bhakti, not just any knowledge will do. Now, here is a quotation from someone called Chandra Shekhara Bharati, who was the spiritual head or the acharya of the Sringeri monastery. So there is a certain American Christian who says, you know, I want to become Hindu. And he says, do not become Hindu, rather be a better Christian, follow your own Swadharma as a Christian. It is no freak that you were born as a Christian. God, that is, by God he means Brahman. Brahman ordered it that way because by the samskara or by the karmic impressions acquired through your actions in previous births, your soul has taken a pattern which will find its richest fulfillment in the Christian way of life. So instead of trying to become a Hindu, there is no hurry. There is enough time. You will have many, many more lifetimes. So be a good Muslim, be a good Hindu, or sorry, good Christian or a good Jew in this lifetime. And finally, you will find your way back to us. So this is the second reason why the truth question is either bypassed, circumvented, or denied, or obscured, or people shy away from this. Now here's a third reason, which is the sort of, again, this is one more binary opposition, that Hinduism is orthopraxy, and Semitic religion is orthodoxy. That is, what really matters in Hinduism is not what you believe. You feel free to believe whatever you will. Right practice, you have to get the right form of religious behavior, right form of religious observance, whereas the Semitic religions are all about orthodoxy. again, you know, I'm touching upon an extremely complex topic, but here's a quick response. There are two ways of reading this statement, that Hinduism is about orthopraxy, Christianity is about orthodoxy. Here is reading one, that Hinduism is only about orthodoxy. Now, this will depend on what kind of social ethnographic work you are doing, who are the Hindus you are meeting. Definitely, this will not apply to Madhusudana Saraswati or the great Vedantic scholastic thinkers. They will not agree that it is only a matter of believing. For them, it is only a matter of practicing. For them, it is vitally, crucially important that you get the right belief, whether it is Advaita or whether it is some form of Advaita and Bhakti, whether it is some form of Bhakti. So this is reading one, which we will not do. Reading two is this, that there is more orthopraxy in Hinduism than in Christianity. Now for this, you will have to read, 500 books and arrive at this quantitative judgment as to whether there is more here or more or less. Why do we continue to think that Christianity is all about orthodoxy? My suggestion is that many of these modern Hindus in colonial Bengal, colonial Madras from 1920 onwards, they viewed Christianity through the prism of the European Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. That is what religion meant to them. That is Christianity meant to them. And of course, if you are living during the English Reformation or the Protestant German Reformation, then it is crucially a matter of getting your right belief. Because otherwise you will get burnt. That's how bad it is. But to think that even today, Christians wake up in the morning and they decide, well, first let me read Thomas Aquinas and tell me why this is Thomas Aquinas' view of the real presence as opposed to Luther's view of Christ's sacrifice as a memorial. This is simply not true. For many Christians, they live out their everyday lives as a form of orthopraxy. I go to church, some Anglican might tell you, because this is where my grandmother got married, and that's where it ends, right? So this binary, Hinduism being orthopraxy, therefore truth claims don't matter here, and Christianity is orthodoxy, they're obsessed about truth, is simply, from a social ethnographic point of view, not true. And then the fourth one is more to do with an institutional academic reason. That is the reason for why truth claims have disappeared from Hindu academic discourse. Rightly or wrongly, in academic circles sometimes and outside academic circles sometimes, we believe in something called postmodernism. So there is a decline of master narratives. And this is precisely the kind of master narrative you will have to generate to talk about truth claims. So when Madhusudana Saraswati is writing in medieval India, he's not saying that these claims are valid only for South Asia. These claims are true for absolutely everyone anywhere, whether you are on the Andromeda galaxy or whether you are in Alaska. These sorts of truth claims, our academic cultures, rightly or wrongly, again a very complex debate, are rather hostile to. So this is more to do with some sort of an institutional academic culture, the spirit of the ages sort of argument. What about the other way around? And this is my last argument. Why is it that, let's say, Western, possibly from Christian points of view, from Christian perspectives, why don't we find the question, is Hinduism true? Right? That is, so far I've been talking about Hindus asking the question, is Hinduism true? And I have been suggesting some reasons why you do not find too many Hindu academics or Hindu thinkers raising this question. But what about Christian or Western academics? Say, if you go back in time to 1915, this was a booming, thriving industry of trying to tell people why Christianity is the final absolute truth and why Hinduism is not the final truth. So why don't we find Western academics, possibly from Christian backgrounds, trying to answer this question? Again, very complex topic, but here's my slightly, maybe hopefully not too provocative, but slightly provocative suggestion. This is partly to do with the socio-political edge of our academic discussions. I think that there is a sort of deep anxiety that if you try to demonstrate the intellectual coherence of Christian thought vis-a-vis certain specific Hindu traditions, you are going to be accused of being Eurocentric. That is, people in India today, the Hindu right, and there are many different configurations elsewhere, will say, look, this is just another version, another reiteration of the old colonial discourse, that here you have Westerners trying to show that a certain Semitic religion is cognitively coherent, consistent, and not a very specific Hindu traditional form of life. But to this, here's my response, to put it bluntly. I mean, surely we have moved on from 1947, this is 2015, whereas in 1947, many of these arguments were indeed offered and structured by very heavily racialized vocabularies, where the attempt to demonstrate the cognitive coherence of Christianity went hand in hand with trying to demonstrate European superiority. In academic spaces, I would like to believe we have moved on. Whereas outside our academic spaces, maybe there is still a time lag, but we don't have to give in to this sort of external world pressure, where simply to demonstrate that one religious system is cognitively, has certain cognitive merits, has certain spiritual, experiential merits that another system does not have. Simply to attempt to try to do this should not be written off in advance. Of course, whether we succeed in doing this or not is another attempt. And as I've indicated, in 22 years I have not succeeded. But we might succeed. And I would not like to write off that attempt straight from the beginning by quoting 1947.
Shall I just start?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, that's a brilliant talk. Thank you very much. And, very helpful. I'm going to get at the question from a slightly different point of view, from a philosophical point of view. And, of course, the question of truth in general is one of the basic philosophical questions, and there is no agreed philosophical answer to the question, what is truth? So I'm not talking at the moment about specifically theological truth, but what is truth about anything? And there are huge philosophical debates, and I suppose one of the chief ones is whether truth is some sort of correspondence, that is, you have something called facts, then you have something called concepts, and if the concepts correspond to the facts, then those concepts state what is true. That theory is not very popular for various reasons, although it seems common sense. Our words ought to correspond to the facts in some way. It gets into trouble because philosophers try to work out exactly what is the correspondence. The words don't look like the facts, so what is it? So that's not terribly telling these days. But you have other views, and one of the prevalent ones at the moment in Anglo-Saxon philosophy is that truth is agreement. That you get agreement with something, and if you get agreement with people, then they will say that's true within their circle. That's a very relativistic view, but it's quite a popular one. Well, I'm not going to talk about truth in general. I just want to say it is a very disputed topic. So it's not just in theology that we have the disagreement. It's the very basis of truth itself. When it comes to theology, therefore, there are lots of disagreements in theology, but one of the most basic is what truth is anyway, and what could you mean by, if I take theology to mean thinking about God or the supreme reality, what might you expect truth to be in that area? Well, let me say first, people often ask me whether I'm a relativist. Right? I don't know why they ask me that, but they say, do you think that everything is true? A relativist is a person who thinks this is true for me or this is true for my group, but a different group can have something else that's true. It's very compelling, or at least seems to be in ethics, where people will say, ah, that's what you and your group thinks, that you can only have one man and one woman having a marriage. But in a different group, you can have people saying, no, you can have lots of different men, lots of different women, in all sorts of different relationships, and they might all be marriages. Right? So you might say that's not about truth at all. But if you're going to say truth exists in ethics, a relativist view would say, well, different people just have different things, and there's nothing, there's no neutral way of deciding between them. So you could say that. And I suppose in religion, this would be called a pluralist view. We use that word rather than relativist. Pluralist view that there are many different truths, and different people might be in one set of truths, but not in the other. And there's no way of deciding between them. So what I want to do at this stage is to make a very strong distinction between whether there is a way of deciding that something is true or not, and whether something is true or not. Well, on one hand, you say, is this statement true? And I think in many topics, you could say it's either true or false. So if I say this is a watch, that's either true or false. You can't say, for some people it's a watch, but for other people it's a banana sandwich. Well, you really couldn't say that. So there are some things where you say it's true that it's a watch. But the question of how you would know that it's true is a very different question. I mean, you actually know that this is true by looking, by listening, by various sensory mechanisms. But there are more complicated things where you might not be sure. For example, let me ask the question, is the theory of relativity true? Now, most people would say yes, but they would say that on authority because they don't really know whether it's true or not. But they would say, yes, I think it's true. But it turns out that in modern science, it's agreed by everybody who knows about it that the theory of relativity contradicts quantum mechanics. It's a contradiction. They can't both be true. But actually, physicists say they are both true, so they've got a very strange situation. And the reason you can do that is because they don't actually overlap in any important place. So the quantum mechanics talks about very small things, relativity on the whole talks about very large things, so you're not going to get into a conflict. So you just keep them both going. But what you say is, actually, we aren't in a position to say that one is absolutely true. We need to use relativity in some scientific contexts, and so we regard it as true. We need to use quantum mechanics in other contexts and regard that as true, but we don't pretend that there's one what's called theory of everything. Right? A theory of everything would be a scientific theory which explains everything in one coherent theory. There's no such thing. And some scientists say, well, I wish there were, you know, I wish there was a theory of everything, and they look for it, but we all agree it hasn't been found. Now, the point I'm making here is that something must be true in this area. I mean, if quantum mechanics and relativity theory really do contradict one another, as they do, there must be something wrong with one or both of them. But it doesn't matter very much, because they both do what we want them to do, and we have no way of finding out what the truth is. So that makes the point that asking the question, what is true, is different from asking the question, how do we find out what is true? I think in physics today, people would say, and I think rightly, something is true. I mean, there could be some propositional way or mathematical way of saying what the universe is like, but we don't know what it is. We don't know what it is because we don't have the concepts to express it. So we have no way of discovering the truth. We just don't have the equipment to find out what the truth is. So in religion, just to make the connection, people like me would want to say there is an absolute truth. Something is absolutely true, but we don't know what it is. And when I say we don't know what it is, I don't mean we know nothing. I mean that it doesn't matter what you do, because I would want to use that scientific analogy and say some things might work for some situations, but not for others. You might understand how this is the case, but there is no, in religion, there is no overall accepted, despite what Avaitans might say, there is no overall accepted view of what is absolutely true. So I think I would want to rule out the possibility of absolute truth in religion and say that's not a matter of just religion, it's a matter of almost everything. That all statements of truth are provisional. So let me, although truth is absolute, so there's my slap paradox. Truth is absolute, but every statement of truth is provisional because there's usually, or very often in some areas, no way of knowing which view is true, even though it's very important to know, and you have to commit yourself to the truth of some view. As is true in physics, you just have to. It's very well known that Einstein never accepted the truth of quantum mechanics. He spent 20 years of his life trying to disprove quantum mechanics. He failed. But he might have been right. You really don't know. So you go for the best statement that you have. Right, so that's where I'm starting. The truth is very different from how we could know what the truth is, and it's very different from our statements of the truth. So now I'm going to move on to consider what it is to state the truth. because truth is a property of propositions. That's a dogma of philosophy. It might be false, but I think it might be true. Who knows? Depending on what truth is. So, if you say truth is a property of propositions, you say propositions are made up of concepts, they're made up of words, but only if you have certain concepts can you state certain truths. Right? Your statement of truth depends on the concepts you have. So if you don't have the concept of a boson, for example, then you wouldn't know what it meant to say that there was a Higgs boson. Right, because you wouldn't know what it was talking about. I believe that most people don't know what it's talking about, but there you are. You've got to have the concept, and you've got to know roughly what it means before you can decide whether or not it's true. So I think that in Oxford, there are only about 50 people who really know whether it's true that there is a Higgs boson, and I'm not one of them. Mm-hmm. I believe it's true, but again, that's on authority. People who work in Geneva tell me that it's probably true. But even they, actually, if you press them hard, will say, we're not really quite certain. It might not be the best explanation. There may be something that we haven't thought of yet. And there's the point. There might be some concept we haven't yet developed. Take another example from science, electron, the concept of electron. It used to be thought the electron was a little planet, a little solid thing that went around. Now, that's not the case, but if you ask somebody what an electron is, you need to have some very sophisticated concepts to understand the answer that you would get. So you couldn't even begin to explore truth in certain areas like physics, which is about the nature of reality. That's why it's near to religion in many ways. You're talking about the nature of reality. And even in physics, which is just about physical reality, and therefore perhaps a small part of reality, even in physics, you need to have the concepts before you could even understand what the truth was. And if you don't have the concepts, you're bound to say, I have no hope of getting an absolute truth because you'd need a language which was suited to it. So what you do in those situations is you content yourself with provisional truth, or truth which works in a certain area of discourse. Can I make the move from physics to religion? Well, try it like this. That just as in physics, it's no use looking for a complete theory of absolutely everything. You know, the worst one in physics is that physics explains absolutely everything in the universe, rather, and that's a claimed total knowledge. Physics shouldn't make that claim, so should religion make that claim? Does it really sound reasonable for any religious person to make that claim? My view would be, I don't think that would ever be reasonable. I think it would never be reasonable for anybody to say they have the absolute truth, because I don't believe that any human being has the concepts which would correspond to, if that's what we're looking for, the absolute truth. Now, it would be anathema to some philosophers to say you might have knowledge which is non-conceptual, that is, there might be some way of knowing the truth without being able to put it into concepts. But I wouldn't say that that doesn't make any sense. I would just say that if there's some way of knowing the truth without having any concepts to express it in, then that truth cannot be expressed, full stop. So it really isn't much use if you're talking to say, I know a truth which I can't describe to you, because you're not communicating. I mean, that's it. If you can't describe it, you can't communicate it. So that's a very odd use of truth. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's odd because truth that doesn't have concepts is certainly not correspondence truth. It would have to be something very different. And it would be very difficult to say how you could distinguish one of these non-conceptual truths from another one, because you have no concepts to make the distinction, right? And so how do you know whether what the person claims is actually true or not? There might be no problem if people didn't disagree, but unfortunately people who claim to have mystical, non-conceptual, direct experiences of truth, as Zen Buddhists do, some of them, people who claim that all disagree with each other when they come to talk about what that truth was, which is not surprising because they're not supposed to be able to describe it. But, which leads me to another point, which is that perhaps the descriptions we give of truth, if they're all partial, if none of them can possibly claim to be adequate to stating what the absolute truth is about the whole nature of reality, then you might want to say that all human concepts are inadequate to stating what the truth is. And I think actually that's what you find if you read the greatest writers on religion, now the greatest writers within religious traditions. So you take Thomas Aquinas, I think everyone would say he's a pretty good philosopher and theologian. And Thomas Aquinas, 13th century, would say, well, God, and he starts the Summa Theologia, one of his great works, by saying, we do not know what God is. So he's not going to give you, he's not going to say God is a person or anything like that. And then he goes on to say, well, using Latin, of course, but he says, God is being, pure being. Actus puris, pure act. Or esse suum subsistens, which is literally to be subsisting on its own. I just point out that doesn't make sense. It literally doesn't make sense to be existing on its own. And a real termist would have to try to explain to you how esse, to be, could actually mean being. It doesn't. So there's a great mystery about what Aquinas means. So when people talk about Aquinas' view of God, they need to remember that he didn't have one, really. Except that God isn't anything that you can understand that could be named. And he does specifically say this. For example, Aquinas says, God is good, and that is true, he says, that is true, but no one can understand what good means. So what's the point of saying it's true? So, you know, something I can't understand is true. And I think Aquinas is really saying that we cannot comprehend God. We can say things about God, but we can't claim that in the sense that we understand those things, like God knows something or God is good, what we understand actually belongs to God. You know, notoriously, Aquinas said, God has no properties. So that's not going to help very much. God is the nameless. So that's the apophatic path, and it exists in every great religious tradition, certainly exists in Advaita. But what are the implications of this? Well, I think the implications are, if there's something which you're not claiming to know in any describable sense, how can you disagree with anybody else? Unless they say that they can describe exactly what the ultimate reality is like. Those are the only people you can disagree with. So I do disagree with people who know what God is like, or people who know that there isn't a God. I can disagree with them. But I can agree with everybody who says it's all very difficult, or I haven't a clue. You can agree with them. So at the highest level, I seriously think religious thinkers cannot disagree with one another. They can disagree with each other at a very low level. I mean, they can disagree about particular facts of history. Jesus died on the cross. Jesus didn't die on the cross. You can disagree with each other about that. So, yes, lots of things you can disagree about. But if you're talking about the nature of ultimate reality, disagreement is not possible. But difference is possible. And here I come towards the end of what I say. Difference is the metaphors you use to talk about what you cannot describe. Wittgenstein famously said in his book Tractatus, he finished off with a little proverb, which comes from a Buddhist source, in fact, but it's become famous in his version, and that is, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And I'm saying that's not true. Okay. Wherever one cannot speak descriptively and directly, you can speak in metaphor and allegory, in a poetic sort of way. And in that sense, you might say some metaphors are truer than others. I think that would make sense within religion, but what does that mean? It's not correspondence, rather. But you might say, well, And here I offer a formula, which may or may not be helpful. The formula is that religious concepts aim to sketch a way of overcoming the sense of ego and obtaining relationship to a reality of overwhelming value or goodness, which you cannot further describe. And if that's true, then sets of concepts in religion, different sets of concepts, will have different ways of approaching that practical process, the praxis, if you like, of overcoming the egoistic self and obtaining a relation to something greater, higher, more valuable than yourself, but for which there is no absolutely correct description. You will prefer some description to others. So some people will say, not God. What Akira said is the transpersonal absolute, okay, which has the characteristics, however, of intelligence and bliss. And other people will say a person, but they'll say, well, I admit it's not really like a human person. What characteristics does it have? Well, perhaps intelligence, wisdom, compassion, and bliss. Sounds roughly the same sort of thing, but put in a slightly different way. And isn't that just what you'd expect? Because neither of them is descriptively correct, nor can they possibly be. So, just to conclude the summary, there is absolute truth. Nobody has a hope of knowing what it is, and I think it's very unhelpful in religion for anybody to pretend they have it, so they should stop saying that. The best theologians have not said it. They've said that we don't know, we cannot describe, the absolute is ineffable, the Tao that can be spoken is not the true Tao, we all know about that. But you have to use truth in a different way and talk about metaphorical truth or symbolic truth. And there, perhaps, you might want to say, we're not in any position to say which set of metaphors are the most appropriate to humans, so maybe you should stick with the ones that you know. And I myself would recommend what I would call expansive faith, that is, commit yourself to a tradition, but be as expansive as you can be in learning from other traditions and other sets of metaphors which might expand your vision of what things are. But never, never say that what you believe you know to be the absolute truth.
Is it my turn? Gosh. I agree. So I don't. I can leave now, obviously. Brilliant. Well, in some ways, I'm carrying on from those things, but I think I'm speaking from a particular perspective. The whole truth in religion debate has gone through so many phases, through the assertion of truths, the fighting over truths. In the 20th century, I think a strong sense of the conflict between different religious truths. But also in the 20th century, we've had this kind of revolution in truth, as it were, that comes with, if you like, a post-Kantian perspective that says, amongst other things, truth is not always, as Keith said, the correspondence theory of truth. It is not always necessarily the kind of thing where we believe there is something. I use words that are meant to adequate our course, to correspond to that thing. Actually, I may not know the thing is really there. All I'm ever dealing with is the words. And so I'm going to have to approach discourse and its truth claims in a new way. All of this comes out, of course, out of the post-Kantian turn against the notion of a thing in itself, knowing, or as Keith has pointed out, making any kind of claim to know what's out there and be able to talk about that. And here, not just in relation to God, I think in relation to everything. So I'm speaking to that turn in attitudes towards truth that happened in the 20th century. I'm speaking to it particularly from the perspective of a thinker who I've worked on a lot, but who is, I think, most associated with that turn towards a post-Kantian truth, which is Hans-Georg Gadamer, of Truth and Method, if you like, the hermeneutic revolution, this attempt at a new way of truth, which I think, in a weird way, Gadamer writes, he wrote, if you've ever tried to read Truth and Method, the most boring book in history.
No,
it's just
boring.
It's pretty boring. But also, it's one of those odd books. Some of the greatest books in philosophy are terribly boring, long, and true, or just very well-reasoned. Sometimes writing well-reasoned things mean you have to be long and boring. So I think what's happened, in fact, is that the things he says get assimilated into most of the humanities as a working model of truth. So I'm going to speak from that a little bit, and I'm just going to speak about a hermeneutic account of what truth, and particularly religious truth, would be. But I'm also going to go beyond that to argue that even for this apparently relativistic, apparently anti-correspondence theory, apparently non-realist thinker, Gadamer, he also has his own theological idea of religious truth and has a very strong program for how engaging in truths, religious truths and others, particularly religious, philosophical and poetic truths, bring you to an understanding of the absolute reality. But we'll see that it's a different kind of absolute reality from the pre-Kantian version where I'm talking about a God who's out there. Okay, so, and actually, I'm going to hand, if you want to take one of those and just sort of hand them around as I go along. I even printed out handouts. So, properly understood, we're looking at a model of truth that comes after the critique of the realist debate. We're looking at a model of truth that emerges. There's a story, if you like, that you can tell of the way that people have thought about truth through the last 1,000 years. And Gadamer tells this story in Truth and Method, and I'm going to rehearse it for you because I think it's a helpful perspective. So before we get to what's there on the page, here's the story of the history of truth, and the story goes like this. Once upon a time, people's notions of truth were much more intuitive. They were embodied. They had beliefs, and they lived according to them. They expressed them through arts, and they would indeed have discussions about what they felt was or was not true and what it meant to say that something is true. One version of history says, in a pre-scientific period, meant something more like, A, am I going to encounter this reality? Is it true there's a bear in the forest? And then your truth relates to particular forms of experience. Or maybe they meant something like, is it true that love is a good thing? And that means partly, will I encounter love as a good thing, but also, do you believe in love? Is it a value that informs your view of the world? Right? On this model, early notions of truth took different forms. Sometimes they pointed to values, sometimes they pointed to potential empirical experiences, and other things as well. And in fact, for that, one can go back to Aristotle's different accounts of truth, the idea that when Aristotle talks about truth, he has not one version, but many, which include, if you look at the second paragraph, that classical models of truth, phronesis, often translated as practical wisdom, the truth of knowing how things work, how to do things, how to live, truths in their complex character, right? So not is there a glass on the table, but rather, how do glasses work? Where do they come from? How do we engage them? What is their history? What is their place in our discourse and lives? Notice that that's a much more complex notion of truth than the correspondence theory, is it there or not? But you also get techne, more technically, how to engage with the truth, with the glass, let's say. Episteme, how can I measure, how can I quantify and regularize and convey my knowledge of a particular truth? And also things like nous, what is my intuition, my immediate engagement and awareness of that truth? Aletheia, how is it emerging from my broader awareness of things? Poesis, how to craft, to create, to use that glass in the creation of new, perhaps more poetic truths. On this version of the history of truth, we started with a much more complex model. And this version then goes on to say that what happens, this continues for quite a long time, but at some point with the development of what we call the sciences, it becomes more and more restricted into a quote-unquote scientific model of truth. And that's something that emerges at various points. Some would argue that it starts with Aristotle and his interest in the natural sciences. Some would argue that it carries on with Aquinas. I think Gadamer, for instance, gives his own version where it's in the medieval period that not so much Aquinas, but people like the Paris Occamists, William of Ockham, the Englishman, inspires a Parisian group of philosophers who, interestingly, oppose the idea of Plato's realm of ideas. And they're radical empiricists, and they say, what you see is the real. That's our access to what is real. And what you then do is you relate this to mathematics as an analysis of reality, and you need to map the real world around you into a set of regularized technical data. It's a mathematization of reality. So I'm no longer asking about the poetic truth, the larger context, practical use, and other forms. It's all become episteme, a quantification, if you like, of the truth. And Gadamer argues that this continues with the growth of the natural sciences. It mixes with skepticism. So once we get to Descartes, people start asking, how do you know these mathematically regularizable things are true? And so the onus moves into collecting empirical evidence that proves a certain set of ideas. And the hermeneutic account says that this is all very useful. It's highly linked to episteme. It makes everything regular. It's highly linked to techne. You can then use it for specific technical tasks. Hence progress of modern science, right? Hence modern world. But it's cut out the other forms of truth. Gadamer argues that there was a brief reaffirmation in humanism, so you get figures who do both science and poetry in the Renaissance period, people like Leonardo da Vinci or Francis Bacon, or even, he notes, Leibniz and Spinoza, and even Descartes, who we forget has a much wider engagement with the humanities, with the arts, is interested in a whole range of explorations of truth as in a rich reality that includes meaning, that includes experience, as well as regularized data about things that you can capture in words. But that gets progressively lost, particularly with the rise of skepticism and what the Enlightenment does to truth. So that we get little sparks here and there of people trying to regain that holism. That includes Wilhelm von Humboldt, who is seen as the father of the humanities. He notices that von Humboldt says, when we study the human sciences, we need sciences that engage in all the different forms of meaning and meaningfulness. There must be a human sciences that balance out the natural sciences and bring back reality in its richness. And that heritage continues, and Gadamer argues that the phenomenologists try also to bring back a richer, wider range of forms of the real. And that's why he himself joined in phenomenology. He writes about the early 20th century. He says, as a young man in the 20s trying to figure out what to study in the universities of the time, the only people who seemed as if they were promising to bring back reality were the phenomenologists, these wacky post-Kantian people who now we see as crazy relativists, but actually then they were the ones bringing back the real. So that's the story that Gadamer tells. He says the problem is phenomenology has remained, and the people like phenomenology who want to bring back the rich reality indices, if you like, have remained on the margin. Science has become increasingly dominant, and science is very narrow, empirical and quantitative conception of the real has become by far the dominant one, so that religion has started fighting science by trying to make science-like claims, forgetting what Keith said, that actually the objects of religion are not necessarily susceptible to science-like claims. Sort of going back to when early Jews argued about whether God had a body and where you could find his body and how big and how heavy, you're missing the point of the God idea, in a sense, when you try and capture it in that way. So how to bring it back? Well, fairly briefly, I'll give you an account based on that newer hermeneutic model. As a sort of structure here for understanding how the hermeneutic view, and this is really a Heideggerian hermeneutic view, it's not Ricoeur's view, it's not the French model, which still thinks there's a thing in itself out there. Gadamer, who follows Heidegger's fulfillment, quote-unquote, of Kant, says that what the real is that we have access to is not something out there behind my perceptions. It's not something on the other side of my experiences. It is this. It's happening now. This is the real, i.e. the sum of experience in all of its richness and its complexity. So what we experience is not a veil hiding the real from us. It is the manifestation of the real right now. And that's, I won't go into that, that's a complicated thing. It can be very counterintuitive. People keep going, yes, but if this is my experience, what is it experience of? And if you're post-Heidegger, you say you don't ask that because anything you're talking about would still be an experience. it's all experience. That doesn't mean this isn't idealism or solipsism. You're not losing reality. Rather, this has always been what we mean when we talk about the real. So then to study reality is to study this. And Gadamer, in his own view, then goes to look at what is the nature of truth. So on the handout you've got, a model of truth as being twofold. You two don't have this, but apologies. The model of truth is twofold. On the one hand, there is the truths that are associated... The truths that are associated with speech. There's actual speech, the things that you say, and you can then assess the things that you say to see if they're true. Gadamer's actually, he doesn't want to get rid of that. He doesn't want to say everything is magical poetry or just expression. He's not a pragmatist in terms of language or a performatist in terms of languages. He says, when I speak and say, I think that there is a miracle happening next door, I think that Jesus was killed, or I think that that man was just possessed by a spirit and there's a God. He says people are really saying something that can be evaluated for its truth or its falsity. They're not just exclaiming enthusiastically about their values. So speech is important and expresses certain ideas. But he reminds us that speech happens here against the background of the uncaptured inner word. He borrows this phrase from Augustine, actually. The idea that everything we say has an uncaptured element, an evocative pit. All the ideas that are not expressed in what I said, but are somehow implied in it. And this is an important part of just accepting what speech does. So if I say, the cat's in the other room, it seems very simple. If I say, I'm not fully happy about that, that's not a simple statement. It includes a huge amount. If I say, I hope it rains tomorrow, no, it's another emotion. If I say, it's supposed to rain tomorrow, there's a whole actual set of meanings behind that support what is apparently a very simple statement. You see this even more clearly if you say, I love you. What does that mean? It means so many things that that phrase has almost become a symbol rather than any kind of statement of fact. And that that might be also true of the idea of I believe in God, or there is a God, that it's in fact an incredibly rich, complex, evocative statement. When you say it, there's much that is not captured, both about the idea of God and what you mean when you say that. So that statements exist as claims, but they also have a background, if you like, a sort of an aura of elusive, alluded to meanings behind them that he refers to as the inner world word. And he also reminds us that particular statements that you say relate to the broader idea of language as something that enables all speech or statement or meaning to happen, i.e. whenever any spoken claim is made, what I'm also doing is enacting the very principle. Let me take that back. Spoken language is really just a manifestation of meaning itself. Okay. And people often get confused that Gadamer said language is being. Right. So spoken language is actually reality. And that's not quite what he meant. When he says language, what he means is meaning, and he actually means experience. He means all experiences of meaning are in fact being, i.e. this is being. So that when we speak, when we engage in truth and truth acts and claims of all sorts, I know we haven't got much time, then we are actually pointing to the broader phenomenon of meaning, of experience, of the content of the world. So that language acts on two levels in terms of specific words, statements, claims, which can then be actually evaluated according to effectively a correspondence theory of truth. But also he wants to say that all language refers us to the upwelling of experience itself in what we're experiencing at every moment, meaning as a whole, which for him is being. Okay, now I'm going to do this in the last bit in 2 minutes. But I don't know when we started, but anyway, it's about right. On the one hand, that means there are two levels of meaning that come out of that, two kinds of truth. And they are as follows. On the one hand, that means that you can have from specific statements, you can map them against the larger picture of the world that they relate to. So if I say the cat is in the other room, then I'm making statements that involve a background of ideas about cats, about rooms, about spatial relations, okay? And I'm also, so already we can assess that for its coherence with the meanings that they are sort of tied into. I can also assess it, if you like, in a realistic sense, against my likely experiences as I go forward. So if you then say, yes, it is, I'm going into the other room and you see a cat, then this statement has made an accurate claim about the world that you inhabit, the worldview, the meaning system, if you like, that you inhabit. So that means that I, in terms of religious truths, what that means is you can assess these statements against people's general system of meanings and also against the experiences that you have. Okay, is this correctly corresponding to the world that you're in? So this is quite a common theory where correspondence is turned into a coherence. Am I fitting within the broader network of meaning that is determining the world I live in, the meanings that I engage with? And that correspondence theory is important. Gadamer has a whole theory associated with it where he calls it the sensus communis, the communal meaning that everyone shares, that binds your life into a certain shape through which you think and experience things. And meanings that correspond with that are effectively true, at least for that set of truths. Someone else, on the other hand, may have a different set of truths, in which case it will not be true. In that other community, it will not be true. For Gadamer, that accounts for the real in the way that we usually use it when we ask whether something is true or not. That is, in fact, a mapping of what we usually call realism. Did you find it to be true? Is it a guide to our experience? Does it make sense in terms of your ideas? Does it reflect the world? Yes, there's your coherence theory. But the part that I want to end on, I think, that's an interesting notion for him, just noting that that coherence theory in his version is not anti-realist, as people used to think it was. It's not Don Cupid, it's not Rudolf Bultmann, and if you know those thinkers, that means he's not saying that religious truths are just about your feelings or just about your perceptions. He's saying, in such cases, religious truths are genuinely maps of the reality that we experience. And if you make a claim and then your experience fails to confirm it, then the claim was not true. Okay, so this is not the non-realism of Don Cupid and the rest. But because Gadamer thinks that there's another level of language, that language is being, that all of this is an upwelling of that strange and extraordinary reality, then he also says, notice that when you assert truths, when you experience truths, and when you watch them happening and going into action around you, you are watching being happen. Okay, now Gadamer doesn't believe in God particularly, but he does believe in the real, the ultimately real, which is this. And he's fascinated by the way in which all truths show us the world coming into existence, show us something which for him has a deeper and almost theological meaning. And so finally, certain kinds of truths do that better than others because they, instead of closing us into a particular system of ideas, they open us out to notice the wider range of forms of meaning that escape our usual round of assumptions. Philosophy does that, insofar as philosophy asks big questions about the whole of being. It makes us stop focusing on the particular experiences we have and widen out to look at the broader issue of meaning experience itself. So that philosophy has an almost spiritual character to it. It reminds us, helps us to see more clearly the world we live in. And finally, that's true, I think, also of religious truths, particularly where they allude to things that cannot be fully captured in meaning. Poetic truths do this as well. They make us notice meaning in its complicated activity around us. And so that also sensitizes us to the real. But finally, religious conflict actually also has a theological function for Gadamer, insofar as when I say, this is my truth, and you say, no, this is my truth, if I do the work that it takes to understand your truth, I enter into your world at least a little bit. I see what it means to think in your ideas, to experience in your way. I change my world and open it out to another. And in so doing, I stretch, to use a metaphor, I stretch being. I see the wider range of things that truth can be. And I see meaning as something that transcends particular truths, but actually links all these truths into one manifestation of what it is to be in the world. So I see multiple realities, and in so doing, sort of transcendental reduction, I see reality itself coming to light through multiple meanings, right? And in a way, to translate this into Keith's idea, it's to say we're not knowing what we're talking about in terms of the object, but we do see that our many ideas of there being an object seem to be coming somewhere. And we see that in speaking and expressing and trying to refer to that object, we are in fact at least approaching the idea that we are having experience and that this is a strange and extraordinary thing that constitutes us. So he's not going to take that and then refer it to the external God out there, but he will say, if you think that being itself is an extraordinary thing, you're having a theological experience, a vision, if you like, of being when you engage in, use, and also stretch and challenge different truths. Sorry, okay, done now.
I think we can thank our three speakers.